All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got another packed show for you this week, so let's just jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an interview I did with Basilisa Alonso just the other day. Basi is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition, and she's helping to build support for and spread the word about seven dreamers and one supporter who were arrested and thrown in jail for occupying the offices of Senator Schumer and Congressman Corbello and demanding that they fight to get the Dream Act passed in Congress or stop the passage of a major spending bill that is scheduled for a vote soon. The seven young dreamers are putting their lives and their future on the line, and it's imperative that people know about this and support them. And opening the show up, I'm very happy to welcome back to the show artist, cartoonist, and writer Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth. And Fish is here to talk with us about his latest book, And Then the World
Blew Up. That's right. And Then the World Blew Up. And it's a collection of cartoons, illustrations, personal essays, and culture war correspondence from an author who's just trying to defuse the apocalyptic bomb that is the miracle of our creation. Dwayne, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Michael. It's good
sure.
to be here.
Yeah, good. I didn't know that. I didn't know that that Mr. Fish was just a product, a result of your mother rejecting a name for a fish. Oh, man.
Yeah, okay. It was ridiculous. You know how when you're 19 and you're ready to save the world, you need a moniker that is not really your birth name?
Yeah. Yes, I'm familiar with that. Although in my family, it was usually idiot.
You're right. Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Idiot would have been a better moniker for me. Darn.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's jump into this because I want people to get a taste of what's going on with this book and what's going on with you. And again, the book is Mr. Fish and Then the World Blew Up. All right. The title, let's just to start in a warm, fuzzy way. What the hell is going on with that title?
Well, it's really funny because, to me, it's an optimistic title. And the reason it's optimistic is that it assumes that the world hasn't yet blown up. You know, because sometimes I walk around and I say, you know, it's actually blown up, and I'm sifting through the debris and desperately trying to see some optimism in the carnage around me. So to me, it says, okay, it's not blown up yet. It's coming. It's sort of a warning. But it actually came out of a story that my best friend from high school actually ended one of his short stories with. And this is back in the 80s. And I think he ended his story by saying, and then the world blew up, because he didn't have an actual ending for his story. And I told him I was going to steal it. And so decades later, I found the perfect time to steal it.
You know, I could have used that ending so many times in so many articles. How do I end this? How do I end this? It would have been so easy.
It makes sense to any equation, really, when you're talking about politics.
Yeah, you're talking about politics in the world today. Damn, man, come on.
Yeah. Well, that was what was interesting, too, about the book had a different title and it had a different opening because I was starting to put it together before Trump was elected. And then following the election, we needed a new way to open the book. And also, it colored the way the book was going, the narrative of the entire book. Because while the Trump phenomenon definitely has some real specific political tragic elements to it that are very blatant, I wanted to approach it too as an existential crisis. You know, I wanted it to reflect more on where we were as a species and what was going on with us as this collective. And so that's why if you look at the very first chapter in the book, it talks about my trip down to watch the inauguration and then participate in the march the next day. And I wanted to discuss that trauma in a poetic way.
Mm-hmm. And?
And that's what I did, because really, and that's what the other reason why the book is made up of so many personal essays, because I really think that, you know, while we're developing as younger people, our personal relationships, and even not even younger people, just how we are as people, how we exist in our personal lives really determine how much engagement we're going to contribute to how we interact politically in a public space. And so that's why I wanted to look at my own demons, look at my own incongruities inside myself. I don't even know how to, because you might be a better judge on how that unfolds, you know, because I wrote these pieces once and then set them aside. And then during the edit, for the final edit of the book, when I reread them, I was like, oh, geez, I've exposed way much more than I thought. I saw myself much more damaged than I previously thought. But it really informed my suspicion on authority figures and just the trajectory of my own political engagement.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting, and you can see that in the process of reading the going through the book and reading it. I spent as much time reading the essays in your book than more than actually anything else you've ever produced, because you know, I'm like reading that, and then it's a remarkable collection of, you know, just what is it, more than 400 pieces that you've done for this book. That's actually really incredible, and as usual, and even more so, given the conditions we're living in right now. The head-snapping effect of this is really intense. But when I saw the combination of all these essays about that start with, yes, you know, they tell stories from when you were growing up, and then they sort of segue quickly into a whole other what's happening now, and then they end up coming back to where you were in the beginning. And it really helps people understand, one, the process that, not just the process you go through, but the process that we're all living under, too, because it puts all this stuff, all this insanity in a certain context that I think is really important for people to understand today.
Yeah, and that's what my hope was, because there's a quote in the book from a French philosopher. I can't remember his name right now, but it's in there. The quote is, "Our opinions become fixed at the point where we stop thinking."
Hmm.
Right. And so when I first read that, which was years ago, it made so much sense to me, because there's so many different distractions that enter into a person's life that stop them from, you know, further investigating certain ideas, cultural ideas, sexual ideas, political ideas. And so that's where they reside, and that's where they think the truth is. So when you have a society as ours is now becoming more and more contemptuous of critical thinking, people where they retard their thinking is starting to manifest itself in really, really dangerous ways for the culture. And it's not even an opinion. It's not even me saying, this is, you know, me, my theory is that things are really screwed up. All anybody has to do is look out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if people know to engage in not just like the political turmoil, or the political revelry, if you're on that side of the aisle. People need to broaden their understanding of life by looking at clues that are inside, you know, inside the ecosystem, not in addition to the culture, to really test their own theories on what truth is. And we have to encourage ourselves to think beyond what we think we know. We got to go past our reflexive thinking when it comes to politics and culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that actually got me too is that when you do that, there's actually a lot of places that you do that. You do that in the essays, but then in the work as well. For some people, it's like, whoa, did he really say that? Or did he really draw that? because I have to tell you, folks, this book. Now, Dwayne has done a lot of writing in this book. I think more writing than I've ever seen him do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very deep, and it's very important to read that. But it's also, the art in it is just stunning. It's stunning in just general terms, but it's also stunning in the way that it makes your head snap and say, damn, man, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there are a number of pieces in the new book that took a really long time to do. There's a lot more, I would argue, serious fine art attempts at satire and commentary. And it really serves, you know, what we've been talking about. If you can get people to be shocked by something. I mean, it's really a job of satire anyway. You know, you want to sort of, you know, blow people's minds, right? You want mm-hmm. to explode their preconceived notions, so then they have to put them back together again. And if you've done your job, they see that their previous notions don't fit comfortably together, and they have to, you know, reassess what they really think and feel about things. And one of the pieces that has gotten a lot of both praise and real serious pushback is at the beginning of the book, and it's my portrait of George Washington. It's a reworking of the famous, you know, oil painting that everybody knows. And what I ended up doing was removing his face to where it is just a very gory image.
It looks like a hand grenade exploded in his head. Okay.
Right. Yeah, and it took me a really long time to do. And it's also something that I find really uncomfortable to look at. Because while I know that I'm sort of defacing an iconic image for the purpose of satire, it's also done in such a realistic way that the visceral reaction to it is that it's stomach-turning. And it still is stomach-turning. But I think that that's what's important about it. You know, if you can connect an ideology or a way of thinking to something that is viscerally upsetting, which I think you can do when it comes to not only our foreign policy as a country, but also our domestic policy, if that's what requires people to then question the viability of how politics manifests themselves in this country and outside of this country, well, then that's necessary. Because as long as it stays just a conceptual conversation about my side says this, you know, it's a sports argument, then nobody's going to understand exactly what politics do to help or really hurt people.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Duane Booth, Mr. Fish, about his latest book, which is just a mind-blowing book. It's And Then the World Blew Up. Now, Duane, one of the things that you say here is that you talk about the idea that a subject is somebody saying that, you know, there's a subject that's it's just taboo. You can't do it. And you say right. that to you, the conventional interpretation of it is substandard somehow, and that the language with which to comprehend it has not been developed yet, that you think that there's no subject that really is taboo, basically, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah, because it's really, there's reality and then there's ways to interpret reality. And reality is indifferent to what we think about it. So, I mean, to say that that is taboo is sort of, it's an externality that we really don't have any control over. So it's silly. So what's left is our interpretation of these things. And these are sort of abstractions. They're connected to reality, but they're really sort of ideas. And if you start to suggest that there are ideas that are taboo, then it really cripples your ability to talk about things and then to comprehend things and then to really affect injustices, you know, to change certain things, right? The danger is keeping things hidden.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you also talk about a world where consensus equals wisdom or an approximation of the truth. And you say that only the only thing that consensus equates is compromise. And I think that's really important. It's true for right. art, politics, religion, whatnot. But it's like that's an important concept to actually operate from as a base where consensus equals wisdom or an approximation of the truth. The only thing that consensus equates really is compromise, because people do. They look at it today. They look at it in what brought this monstrous creep, basically this thing that takes the history of fascism to a whole other level, Donald Trump. You know, people talk about, well, there was a consensus. And even if they talk about there's somehow consensus always fits in, we can look for ways to work it out. We can get a consensus here. We can actually have somewhat come together. And there's a couple places in the book where you have this sort of very stinging, sort of sticking a hot knife into not butter, but into the people who are arguing for one way or another consensus.
Right. No, it's absolutely right. Because if you have, I mean, it's so easy to see. You can begin by explaining that concept to the people by asking them what their favorite color is, right? And they'll name their favorite color. And you will, you know, potentially have a different favorite color, and you'll know in your heart that your favorite color is actually the right color to be one's favorite. You'll judge them ever so slightly. So just imagine that sort of extrapolated into politics and sort of heavier issues, right? So the idea of consensus is creating this gray zone where nobody's exactly truthful, because it's impolite to try to be very, very truthful if you're being contrary to people. So it's really for the sake of decorum and for the sake of our concept of what civility is, we've created these societies that are completely dishonest. Now, that's the public expression of that. Now, you get people alone at home, they're free to sort of say exactly what they think, and it's going to be contrary to how they behave in public. So my whole mission with this book, and generally my mission as an artist, is to try to bring these personal convictions much more into the light and much more into the public square, where they can be, you know, much more vigorously debated, and something closer to honesty can be exhibited. And also the understanding of, I hope this came through in the book and what you're specifically citing, is the idea that truth is really circumstantial. You know, this idea that we can figure out how everything should exist and will exist forever, fair way, is such, it's a mythology that is very, very dangerous. Because then you have to convene a committee to enforce those rules. And if we're talking about rules that were created by consensus, then everybody is numbed. Everybody is, you know, the vigorous honesty that people should be much more interested in engaging in is considered unuseful.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Dwayne Booth, also known as Mr. Fish. And we're talking about the very important book that he just released, And Then the World Blew Up.
Well, yeah, and when you think about things about the rule of consensus, I mean, it's look, you know, consensus, I can't remember which comedian said it, but it was like there was a point where he said, wait a minute, you're going to let these idiots vote and decide what's going on over here? I mean, there really is this danger of, I mean, you end up with the witches' circles, you know, and the burning of witches in Salem and stuff. This is the kind of, and it's happening today. I mean, look at the way that, look at what's, you know, the kinds of things that are being done in terms of the blatant falsehoods, lies. You can't justify by saying they're misinterpretations. There's conscious lies and falsehoods that are being put out as truth because Trump spoke them and said they were truth. And he has all these yahoos voting for him and all this other stuff. And how many people believe something doesn't determine whether something is true or not.
Well, just even to speak to your point about voting, you know, the whole concept of democracy is a little bit more activity inside of a community beyond voting every 4 or every 2 years. That's a mythology that is extremely dangerous because the whole idea that we have this glowing, shining democracy because every few years we vote for a massive mediocrity or somebody who is extremely dangerous and we feel like we've done our duty in a democracy, that's not functioning as a democracy. You have to be politically active in between voting cycles because with voting cycles, what are you trying to do? You're trying to speak passionately and truthfully to a bureaucrat who then has to bring your concept of what should be going on as far as justice and peace is concerned to another bunch of bureaucrats. Moving the society forward, I really hope people start to recognize should be more than getting the right politely worded email into the right inbox.
It's heavy, though, because you look at this, and frankly, I mean, look, there's a search for truth. That's real. There are things that science can tell you about what's real, and they can explain the planets. They can explain the workings of, you know, inside this planet. They can cure diseases. They can work on curing diseases. They can measure the Earth where before, you know, everybody thought if you walked 20 miles, you'd fall off the edge of it, you know? And a lot of those people still are living, and in fact, some of them are in the White House, you know? You look at this, and you think about this, that how important it is to have a situation where people don't go by consensus, but they go by trying to really understand what's underneath it all. What's the bedrock of all this stuff? What's the thing that gives rise to all this? And I thought one of the things that I get from your artwork is that, and I hesitate, you know, it's funny. I always, every time we talk, I always have this problem because I hesitate to call it comics because it's actually deep art. But, you know, it's got such a great, just smacky in the head sense of humor. And the artwork is something that's like, it's astounding, and it also has a lot in common with people who grew up in that same general area that we grew up in, where after the 1940s and into the 1970s and whatnot, and you're looking at this, there's a certain beauty to this that actually, one, displays all the frenetic uproar, but it also, there's a constant search for what's real and what's true and a mockery of what isn't.
Yeah, that's really well put, because one of the things that I hope the book does is confront and name this noise that is preventing people from really recognizing what the truth is, because that's what I see it as. I see it as noise. For example, let's talk about sharks for a second. This is a telling thing to me. I just found this statistic just a few weeks ago. We talk about sharks, and there's people, you go to the beach, and there's always something inside you where it's just like, this could be my day. The waters must be teeming with sharks, and just, I'm lucky if I get out without being bitten in half, right? There's this fear of sharks, right? So if you consider how many people on the entire planet are killed each year by sharks, it's between 10 and 20 people die in a year over the entire world by sharks. Do you know how many sharks are killed by human beings in a year?
No.
This is telling. Are you ready? This is insane. And it's a very similar statistic to what the numbers are for Native Americans that were killed by invading Europeans. It's a huge, there's a huge, huge range, because just as it was with the indigenous population of the Americas over here, they were not seen as people. So you don't count them. You just slaughter them. They're like weeds, right? So as a result, the Indian population, they say it's between 8 or 114 million, because they just don't know. That's the range. With sharks, it's each year the range is between 63 million and 273 million sharks a year.
Boy.
We're eradicating entire species without even naming them. If you flip those numbers, that's just as if sharks were responsible for killing the entire population, men, women, and children of France, England, Italy, and then Canada. You know, that's how brutal the slaughter is. So that's just a, to me, that's just a metaphor for how we are not connected to who we are as a species and what is really going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We just don't know.
Yeah. And you're not even counting land sharks, right?
I am not counting the land sharks.
Or Dwayne has this one drawing in there of the Pope with a his little hat on, his pointed hat. But his hat is actually an open-mouthed shark, it looks like.
Right.
Which I thought was really good. You know, I used to go to a beach in Maryland with my family when we were kids, and I always thought we were going to the beach. And, like, you know, I didn't have any concept of – I was a slow learner. I didn't have any concept of, like, the ocean and stuff. It was a river, right? And I kept telling my father I would be scared when a fish would hit me. And I said, but you don't know. It could be a shark. It could be a shark. And one time he just grabbed me and he pulls me out in the water and he says, there's no sharks in here. He says, if you want to be worried about anything, kid, look over there. You see that border over there, that land over there? That's where the military is doing all the testing of all these horrible drugs that are going to kill you, give you two heads, 7 feet, or rip your eyes out, melt your brain. And that's all that's dumping into the river we're swimming in. So worry about that. Don't worry about sharks.
Right. That's it. And it's a serious lesson, you know, that people should recognize.
Yeah, but it just added to my fears, okay? That's all it did.
Right.
Now I got sharks that are going, oh, no, it's not going to work. Now, Dwayne, tell me this, because there's a section of the book that I don't think I've seen you do this to the extent that you did it in this book, and that is there are these long conversations that they're often posed as you talking with a friend and da-da-da-da, but there's a lot of things that come up that are you, and it seems to me, now I could be like way off base here, and you can just say shut up, okay? But it seems like you're actually voicing both, both people, that you're having this big giant argument with yourself, and I understand where that comes from because there's so much concentrated in this, but it's also a situation where, as in all of your books, and like, for instance, I'm looking at the one you have around Chomsky, or supposedly with Chomsky, and in the end, I don't know whether it's worms or, or cords or whatever, but the whole thing is everybody's just sort of kind of disappeared into this, just this huge morass of pink rope or something.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, damn, man, there's something heavy going on here, but or maybe not. Maybe I was just like, that's how I explain everything. I don't quite understand it, though it's very heavy. Okay.
Yeah, it's my brain unraveling.
Right. Okay, there you go. There's an element to that. When I was looking at that, there's an element to that that occurs throughout the book. You actually put it in those things when people can see how you're actually wrestling with these questions, and then you go into that, and it's your brain unraveling. But then it's also, your brain unravels, but it in a sense, it then opens up to all this other work that you go on and do, which is astounding. Hitting at exactly the right contradiction and making people go, no, he didn't just say that. Or laughing like crazy because you capture something right there that nobody can deny. The letters from the Peanuts characters are just astounding. I mean, and I just couldn't get into those characters. But when I saw them, I thought, okay, Charlie Brown basically tells Linus to go screw himself, basically, so I could grow up. And then Linus is writing a letter to corporate America saying, I'm out of here.
<It's> like, right.
But those are the kinds of things that really are unique about the way you approach everything. And the fact that these books are, and this is one of them that I think that I really value, the essays that are in it, as well as, though it didn't then mean that you didn't do the art, because you, like I said in the description of it, there's about 400 pieces that are there that really you go back to and back to again and again. So let's talk about that whole process a little.
Well, it's funny because the Chomsky conversation is real. There's only a couple things that I added just to get out of the scene with him. He obviously didn't beat anybody up. You know, that's part of the comic strip where that material appears. But the back and forth that we have about the viability of the arts community and its ability to engage politically is from a transcript from an interview that I actually did with him. And it was really interesting because I'm a huge fan of Noam, and I really wanting to talk to him about stuff that I had never heard him speak about. And so that's why I really like that part of the book, because if anybody reads his interviews and knows his work very well, I guarantee you'll find he and I engaged in some conversation you've never heard him engage in. So I was successful there. And as far as some of the other conversations that are in there, the ones that I can think of off the top of my head, I think there's an email exchange with my brother, which is real. There's an exchange between me and a friend, which it takes place in 1984. So it's only accurate to the point of it's the kind of conversations that we would have. I didn't record it. So the presence of other people inside the book, it's literally true where it can be literally true.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got it.
Yeah.
I'm writing that down so I can check it later, think about it, look it up, see what the hell you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about this guy, Dr. John Irving Bentley, because I have to say, I thought, now I understand so much more about your art.
I know. Did you remember that picture from the past? I feel like everybody I've spoken to, I guess we should tell people what we're talking about.
Yes.
It was a picture from the 60s that I remember seeing in a magazine when I was very young. And it's a picture of a person's leg laying on the rug, basically, and a big burn spot where their body once was. And the whole debate about what that picture was, and it's a police picture, is a proof of spontaneous combustion. And the article where I read it when I was younger said that it was. It was a magazine that dedicated to paranormal activities, and this was just hardcore proof that there's a good chance that any one of us at any given moment will burst into flames and disappear, right? So as a child, trying to make sense out of that, you immediately have to go to some sort of divine intervention. You know, what was this person doing? And this person was a doctor. That's what was interesting to me. He wasn't a criminal. It didn't seem like he was being punished for anything. You know, he had a very benign little slipper on that foot that was left on the floor, you know. So I was just like, wow, what went on here? And then it made me go into this place where, is God reading our telepathy? And is he waiting for us to displease him where he will all of a sudden explode us, you know? And so as you see in the piece, I decide to test the theory of trying to offend God with my telepathy. And all of that is true. All of that is absolutely 100% true. And it was a real turning point for me.
Okay. You know, you're really lucky that you didn't go to Catholic school, because you would have been right up there in the stars of the school, man. It was like, come on. Wow. So,
right.
There you go. He's proving God. Okay, there you are, man. There you are.
I feel like I told you this story in a previous conversation, either on or off the radio, but I do remember my one real solid attempt to understand the significance of religion and Christianity in particular. Gosh, I was probably 6, maybe 5, at Sunday school. And my older brother was really into religion and doing the right thing. So I was like, man, I just can't figure this out. It doesn't make sense to me. Until all of a sudden, sitting there, I was like, oh, I had an epiphany where I'm like, I think I can have this make sense. And I remember raising my hand, and the Sunday school teacher said, yes. I said, I think I've got this figured out. She said, oh, really? What did you figure out? And I said, Santa Claus is Jesus as an old man. And I got such pushback and was considered, it was like a really dangerous thing to say. And that's when I was just like, all right, I'm out. I'm never going to understand any of this.
And if you had been in Catholic school, there would have been children assigned to build crosses in the parking lot. Right, there you go. We'll show you.
Right. And for extra credit, nail yourself there.
Right, perfect. Exactly. I wanted to talk about a couple things. I mean, I've always enjoyed your books really a lot and enjoyed talking with you in all the wackiness and all the things that actually, I don't want people to forget this point that actually your work is extremely significant. And you talk about you worry because you don't see any real significant artwork being produced generally nowadays to help deepen our understanding of recent historical events beyond whatever sound bites were given by a 24-hour news cycle.
Right.
And then you also talked about how humor, in your mind, humor often derives much of its potency from simple truth-telling, a comedic snap coming from the shock that the average person experiences when confronted with sheer honesty. And I'd like to talk about those two things now.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. It's really, just think about what the appeal of a joke is. A joke gives you permission to think outside the box. You have to. You have to do that in order to have the joke make sense. And then the joke will really only make sense if, A, it adheres to actual logic in the world or its own logic. You're building a mechanism, right? And the mechanism has to function to make sense. So all of that is just an attempt to, it requires you to forgive alternative point of view, dissent from the mainstream for the sake of getting to the punchline, which people want to hear. So it's just a moment where you can actually be an outlaw yourself. And you'll be much more open to ideas. It's a way to get controversial ideas into people's heads and then into their mouths when they retell it to somebody else as a proof that things shouldn't be taken as seriously and made taboo, like we were talking about earlier. And it's true that I feel like when it comes to artistic expression, it requires a little more time than what you were saying is, you know, the 24-hour news cycle. And really skim broadcasting, which I think is really how news is disseminated now. You know, people get their news in sound bites, and they get it. They don't go deep with any concept. So therefore, you don't need to know any history. Mm-hmm. You don't need to know anything. You're just there to react to the news. And art demands something a little bit more. And I think that just as truth requires more, you know, to understand anything, you need to spend some time with it. And you also need to spend some time with it inside your own mind without the distraction of just hearing it from somebody else. And those precious time, those precious moments of being able to sort of sit inside your own mind to test the validity of different thoughts and ideas is fast going away.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is going to be the last question, the last thing we have time for. And it has to do with, it's sort of a brings two things together. There's one, a question I have about the challenge of doing your art in a world like today where insanity and piggishness abound, but and they sort of rule generally in the society. But then there's also the fact that what you've talked about, or what I've looked at in what you've done, the last chapter of your book, which actually the other chapters are great and they bring together tremendous things both visually and philosophically and understanding and all this other stuff. But then you get into this last chapter, and it's really it's very sharp in terms of going after. I mean, even the way it opens up with this one picture of, and I'll figure out what the hell, and you don't use hell, but what the hell would big black pissed off Jesus do? But then it goes on. You have Obama beating on with a dog, Martin Luther King. You have Obama with a Caesar's head, you know, crown on and yep. Thumbs down. And you have Trump. You rake Trump across the coals a dozen times. This is an extremely, I mean, just really a very powerful thing. And I'd like to talk about just that, the way you actually bring that all together in those final pages of this.
It's really the crescendo. You need a denouement that makes sense when you're talking about all of this material. And it was just important to me, again, to echo the sentiment that we're precious and we're vulnerable beings. And to have that resonate, I needed to expose myself as a precious and vulnerable human being and hope that that tone resonates with people who I hope are enjoying this in a private space and allowing themselves the grace of being able to deliberate on the conversation that I want people to have.
Okay. So I shouldn't be continue doing mine and reading it on the bus and laughing out loud and telling people, hey, did you hear this? Okay. I can do that. Come on. I thought that was helping you out, buddy. All right. Dwayne, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Yeah,
always a pleasure to talk with you, and we'll have to continue this because it's and when you come out here, we'll have to have you come up on the show live, all right?
Yes, I will absolutely do that, and yes.
Okay, great. All right, Dwayne, talk to you again soon, man.
Thanks, Michael.
Take care. All right, that was Mr. Fish, or as he's otherwise known, Dwayne Booth. See, we give him equal treatment here. And we were talking about his new book, and then the world blew up. The book is published by Fantagraphics, and for more on the book and Mr. Fish's cartoons, check out his website, clowncrack.com. Once again, that's clowncrack.com. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Outer National with Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. In September, Trump announced his decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, the Obama-era program that kept undocumented immigrants who'd been brought to the United States as children from being deported. Now, seven DACA recipients were arrested in the offices of Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Representative Carlos Corbello, demanding that they, along with other members of Congress who previously expressed support for Dreamers, live up to their word. The DACA recipients are demanding that members of Congress block any spending bill that does not include a Clean Dream Act. Here to talk with us about this is Bassi Lisa Alonso, who is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. Bassi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and I want to start off by saying that someone called me and said, man, have you seen this? This is so important. There's so much that on the line here, and there's so much bravery, and it's something that people everywhere have to pay attention to, respect, and actually think about what it means for them in the conditions we're living in today. So that's why I wanted to talk with you about this action. So why don't you tell us about the recent action that was taken by these seven students and others who are DACA recipients?
Sure. So on Friday, seven undocumented youth and one ally went to Senator Schumer's office and Representative Corbello's office. The reason why they went there was because these are two people, especially Senator Schumer, you know, who has positioned himself to be a leader and who has multiple times said that he stands with Dreamers. But just last week, he was already backtracking on that and saying that the Dream Act could be brought up for a vote later on. That's something that, you know, is totally different than what he has been saying up until a few days ago. And these really brave people took action because we're asking that this issue no longer gets kicked along down the road, right? We've been waiting for over 10 years. This has been a long time in the making. People are losing their status every single day, about 120 people, and we just can't wait right now. And if they say that they stand with Dreamers, then we need them to prove it.
Now, when you said that it's a very dangerous situation for people right now, why?
Because people are already losing their status. So there are about 120 DACA recipients every day that lose status, as we are seeing with our brave comrades that are in jail right now. DACA is no longer a guarantee protection. ICE has been alerted about one of our colleagues in jail and puts the entire group at risk. So ICE could potentially detain them. Every day that they spend in jail heightens the risk of ICE intervening and perhaps detaining them. And, you know, this is something that can be fixed, right? All we're asking is that Senator Schumer and Representative Corbello come out and publicly pledge that they have the votes necessary to stop any spending bill that doesn't include the DREAM Act.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because actually, I mean, there's a lot of times in what I've been reading about it since yesterday, the day before, it really hit me a lot that there's a question here of when you talk about what the congressional people are saying, what the system is saying to people is very different than what people are actually, what the youth and other people, the Dreamers, are actually demanding. And there's a certain amount of righteousness that's really important that's on the side of the people. And there's a certain amount of, you know, just dishonesty and, you know, just flim-flamming on the side of the system. Let's talk about that a little bit, about the way that's fallen out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is something that we are told some things privately, we're told some things publicly, but essentially what we want is for something to happen already. It's never been our time, right? This issue has never, it's never been the right time for any type of immigration bill to come up. The last time we had any sort of immigration relief was in 1986. And we really just can't wait. We need the DREAM Act now to protect everyone who is losing status. And we always knew that DACA was only a temporary fix, right? Because that was something that we have to renew every couple of years. And we knew that there was always a possibility that if a president was in office who didn't have the same views as President Obama, could revoke that at any time, like it has happened. Politicians have told us, especially Democrats, that they are on our side. And this is something that we're constantly told, we have been told for many, many years, that we should focus on Republicans. But let's not forget that in 2010, the DREAM Act failed because five Democrats didn't vote with their party. And so we just want to make sure that everyone remembers that and that no one forgets that, and that Senator Schumer actually whips his party to not vote for the spending bill if it doesn't include the DREAM Act. And we also need his guarantee that he has the votes necessary to make this happen, to make the DREAM Act happen this week.
You know, that's one of the things that actually really impressed me, is that it seemed to me that what you folks were saying from the get-go was sort of, look, we've played around with these politicians. This is not something that we can continue to play with, that this is a very serious matter for many, many. I mean, look, we're talking about how many hundreds of thousands of people are.
800,000.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that really has got to be resolved, because this is a massive, this is a massive crime against humanity when they're talking about going in and just rolling down the tracks and deporting people. I mean, just picking them up. And it really can. People don't think about this. It really can go from what it is today, where you're having deportations that are sort of, you know, behind the screen. Sometimes they burst out, but it's actually kind of quiet and nobody's really focused on a lot of it, to when you're actually having railroad cars filled with people and deporting them.
And that's something that they can't turn away from, right? What happened on Friday, we're showing them this is what's going to happen. This is going to be our reality if nothing is fixed. Right. And we're also asking that we get the DREAM Act, but with no negative attachments. We don't want any money for Border Patrol. We don't want money for the wall. We don't want our communities to be criminalized, because my parents are not criminals. My parents are the original dreamers. And so we want the DREAM Act, but not at the cost of our families. And that's something that they can't turn away from. Senator Schumer, Representative Corbello, and the rest of Congress will go home and spend a very lovely time with their family for Christmas. But our families, that's not going to be the case. A lot of us go home every single night and don't know if we're going to see our families the next day. And that's the reality that we live in. And I know it's hard for someone who doesn't understand the reality that we live in to wrap their heads around, but that's what's happening. And the fact that seven people are sitting in DC jail right now and who have been exposed to ICE, that's just the reality that Congress can't push aside. They have to face that, because they were arrested and they're in D.C. jail for simply asking that Senator Schumer really prove that he is the leader he says he is and that he really stands with dreamers. And the same thing with Representative Corbello, who says that he stands with dreamers.
Now, you've said a couple times that ICE has already been alerted as to the presence of these youth in jail and that the protesters could be deported. They could actually be picked up right now without even, you know, just them walking in and getting deported like that?
So I'm not sure how the legality works, but we know that ICE is aware of one of our colleagues who is in jail right now. So they have the ability to request that once they are released from jail, that they be detained, right? That they be held for ICE pickup. And they can be transferred to a detention center, and that entire process will just be triggering their immigration hold and could possibly put them in deportation proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you think about this, and it really stunned me, that this is actually a fast-moving machine, as you've been indicating. But just so people know, 11,000 people have lost their status so far, and every day 122 more people lose their DACA status. So every day without DACA actually threatens deportations for hundreds of people, literally, right?
Absolutely, yeah. As soon as we lose our status, we are exposed to deportation, right? And that is especially dangerous for people at border towns because of the interaction with Border Patrol. One thing that Senator Schumer seems to forget is that New York is a border town, right? We border Canada. So there's plenty of people, plenty of farm workers who get deported all the time from interaction with Border Patrol. So losing our protection is horrible, but the other thing is also that we won't be able to work anymore. This is going to be one of the most, a massive layoff, if you think about it like that. We have 800,000 people who are no longer going to be able to work to contribute to society and provide for their families.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the impact on people's families beyond the providing for their families? But what about the impact on people, like, you know, if some students are picked up and deported and or just picked up by ICE or whatever, and they're run out like this, what is the impact on the families that are left behind? Is it, do they then become, you know, susceptible to ICE and all these and deportations and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. And we simply don't know, right? The government said, come out, come forward, come out of the shadows. We're going to grant you this protection. Don't be afraid. We won't use your personal information against you. But we don't know if that's going to be true or not, right, with this administration. This administration could potentially utilize the information that we use when we apply for DACA to go after us and our families.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us this. you know, when you're talking about the people being in jail and all this, it really struck me that there was something, I read some stuff about, it wasn't just people getting arrested like you normally get arrested in a demonstration. You're arrested and then you're, you know, you might be booked on a minor charge, you might be let out and then you go to court later, something like this. But this was actually, people were actually thrown in jail and they made a decision that morally and politically, they were not going to bend to the rules. And they've been undertaking a lot of actions, I understand, in the jail themselves, right?
Mm-hmm. So they were arrested on Friday. Today is the first day that they spent in jail. They have also been engaging in the hunger strike. So their bellies are empty, but we know that they've said that their hearts are full with the strength of the community. We are showing up to show them that we are there, that we stand with them. But again, they can come out tomorrow, right? All we need is Senator Schumer and Representative Curbelo to do their job.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Bassi Lisa Alonso, who is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. And we're talking about a very courageous and important stand taken by 7 DACA recipients and 1 other volunteer to stand up and say that they demand that DACA be reinstated now. As I was thinking about this, and as I was thinking back about what we've just been talking about, you know, I don't want to let these people off the hook. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about the hypocrisy of the Democrats. You have Schumer and all these people, and there's a certain amount of the stench of hypocrisy surrounding everything they're doing in relation to this. Let's talk about that a little.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I come from New York, and when people think of New York, they think of New York City and its, you know, welcoming policies towards immigrants. But I grew up right outside of New York in Westchester County, which is, you know, a little more conservative. And I think that people don't really see New York as a place that's hostile to immigrants, but, you know, anything outside of New York City can be a hostile place. We've been told throughout this very long journey that now is not our time. It's never been our time. Immigration has never, it's never been the right time to do something about immigration. When it's midterm years, they say we can't do that because, you know, it's going to harm Democrats who are running for re-election. For example, when President Obama came in, he said that immigration was going to be his priority. Latinos came out in support because, you know, in addition, yes, to education, to health care, he said he was going to do something for us, and he didn't. We were put on the back burner, and they said, wait, now is not your time. In 2010, when we lost the DREAM Act because of 5 Democrats, they said it was because of the re-elections, right? They were facing tough re-elections. But we're with you, and we'll do something. And then when DACA happened, you know, that was from pressure from our community. We had people sitting in President Obama's re-election offices to bring attention to the fact that he hadn't kept his promises. And so he gave us DACA, but because of the work that the community put in. And then we wanted something more permanent, right? Because we knew that, in a sense, that was just breadcrumbs. But again, they told us, now is not your time. Now here we are in 2017, and we have an administration who is revving up their deportation machine, who they're deporting people indiscriminately. And they're telling us again, this is not the time. So then when is the time? If we couldn't do it under a Democratic president when we had the majority in both houses, and now we can't do it now with a president who is coming after me and my family, then when is the time? We can't wait anymore.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what kind of response have you been getting among people that hear about this? Have there been people coming up to support?
Yes, we have been receiving an outpouring of support from the community. There's been more DACA recipients who are just inspired by this big sacrifice that these 7 people and 1 ally are taking. They're literally putting their livelihood on the line. And that's just something really inspiring. And it's a shame, frankly, that 7 people have to risk deportation in order to move leaders in Congress, right? I really wish that Congress could just have a quarter of the strength that these people are showing right now.
Hmm. Well, that'd be, there's a big, long, hard wish that you're not going to see, sister. I got to tell you that, okay? That's just not going to happen. But here's the thing, because overall, when I heard about this, I was very moved. And I thought, here are people whose their freedom, their safety, their very lives are at threat here. If they
Absolutely.
Dare to stand up and do this, their lives are at threat. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that because it's like there's an overall importance of this action. Saying this at this time under this regime, and we have a fascist regime in power, and to stand up against them like this is not only brave, but extremely important in terms of the example it sets for people everywhere else. Let's talk about that, the overall importance of this action in your mind. And why people took it now.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that these folks are giving us is hope that we can stand up and we can fight back. Even under this administration, we may not be able to vote. We may not be able to pay, you know, high power lobbyists, but we have the power of our stories. And that's what they're using, right? And they're using their stories in hopes to motivate the American public to stand with us because we can't do this alone. We need both affected community members and our allies to stand with us. We need congressional representatives to realize that my friends right now have been in jail for 4 days now. ICE knows about them. And this is something that they can end. Like, we're just asking that they finally do their job after two decades.
Now, you talked about stories, and I think that's very important as well. Let's talk about that. When you say their stories actually can impact people, give people a sense of what those stories are.
So, for example, we have one person who is very young. Her parents are undocumented. They're both farm workers. They work from sundown. They get treated unfairly. Their job is backbreaking. But here she is, you know, speaking up for herself and speaking up for her family and just taking that risk because she knows that even if something happens to her, even if she has to suffer for a week and to get Congress to act, what we're going to get is hopefully protection for her, but not at the expense of her parents, her migrant farm-working parents.
When you say that, I was thinking about that as well. And some of it is when you think about what is it that motivates people overall, because this is not, it's not an easy step to take. I mean, people are stepping out of whatever way that they've been able to sort of make their way through this society, faced with the removal of the Dreamers Act, all this other stuff, and Trump's moves to deport people. All of these things, yet people keep doing this. And that's one of the reasons I was really so, I think it's so important for people to understand what people are facing and the fact that in the face of all that, that they have the heart and the soul and the thinking, the broadness of mind and the dedication to actually stand up against this regime and the horror that it's bringing down.
Yeah, there's a saying, you know, when they take everything away from you, they even take your fear. That's a saying, you know, very popular in Latin America. We've been pushed to the brink where our backs are against the wall. We are at this point laying all our cards on the table. We are, you know, asking, like laying our hearts bare. We are saying, you know, we need your help. We need the American public to make those calls, to hold their members of Congress accountable. And we need our undocumented community to stand up. We're not going to let them drive us back into the shadows. Like, that's what they're going to do. We've been able to come out of the shadows. DACA was a win from the community, right? We won DACA because we had people, like the people sitting in jail right now, who risked a lot. Even with no protection against deportation, they participated in civil disobedience, and they were arrested, and they could have been deported. But they put everything on the line to fight for all of us, for all the 800,000 people who have DACA, and for all their families.
And that part about for all their families and all the people that aren't their families but are part of their bigger family, because I know this is one thing I read in connection with this, is that it was said that, that this isn't just about the permanent protections for undocumented youth, but actually people are acting for all 11 million undocumented people in the U.S. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Just to put things into perspective a little bit, I am also a DACA recipient. And the day that DACA was announced in 2012, I was coming home from my waitressing job. I was in college, working three jobs, trying to finish school. I didn't know what I was going to do. After I graduated from school, I thought that I was going to have this diploma, this pretty diploma, and just hang it on the wall and not be able to do anything with it. And I got home that day, and my mom very excitedly came in. And she was like, you have to come. Come watch TV. You know, President Obama's going to make an announcement about Dreamers. And she was really excited. And I remember being in the room with her and my father, and we were watching the television. And as President Obama came out, you know, my mom, who has broken English, you know, was clinging onto every word. And then he started mentioning the things that would qualify people for DACA. And in my head, I was just doing a mental checklist, like, yes, I qualify for this. You know, I made the deadline. I made the cut. And after the press conference was over, we all just, you know, started crying, and we all hugged each other. And then I had an immense sense of guilt where I said, you know, it doesn't feel right that I get this protection and that you don't. And my mom said, I don't care what happens to me. All I care is that you're okay and that you're safe. And that's what we're fighting for. They're not criminals. You know, my parents are the original dreamers. They came here escaping violence to give me a better life. And like my family, there are hundreds of thousands of other families just like that. So we're saying, you know, we deserve this protection. We've grown up here. This is our home. But at the same time, we're not willing to jeopardize the livelihood of our families.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One last question. What's happening now through Friday, and how can people plug in?
Yeah, for anyone that, you know, wants to stand up, wants to plug in, visit fightforourdream.org. Again, that's fightforourdream.org. Follow us using the hashtags OurDream and CleanDream, and stand up and host something in your district. If you can't come to D.C., host a vigil for acknowledging the sacrifice that these DACA recipients are taking. Hold a sit-in in your congressional representative's office. Hold them accountable. Let them know that this is an important issue to you, the voter, and that we can't wait for the DREAM Act. This is the best time for us to get something. This is the best time where we have some leverage to get the Clean DREAM Act. And we know that if the DREAM Act gets brought up in February or in January, then it's not going to be anything good. It's going to contain a lot of things that's going to be harmful to our communities. We're tired of playing politics. If you are going to let us be taken away silently in the night, you know, there's a saying that you can judge a country by how they treat their homeless, by how they treat their prisoners, by how they treat the people who are the most marginalized. And we are those people. So if you're not going to fight for us and they come for us, and once they're done with us, they're going to come for you.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And there's the big question about where the hell is your humanity? That's mm-hmm. huge. All right, Bossy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here again.
Yeah. And listen, let's stay in touch because I want to follow this as it works out. All right.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you. Take care now.
Okay. Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Bossy Lisa Alonzo. And Bossy is a volunteer for the Our Dream Coalition. And we've been talking about the recent move by seven Dreamers to stand up and demand that Congress pass the DREAM Act immediately. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank my two guests, Dwayne Booth and Bossy Alonzo. For websites mentioned on today's show, check my Facebook page or my website, which is themichaelslateshow.com. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you who tune in each and every week and stay tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little more from Todos Somos Ilegales by Outer National. Talk to you again next week.
I dream of fire, but I sleep. So